Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 413th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron George Ketsios. You can check him out on Instagram at George Ketsios. And you can also check out his production company, PushStopFilms.com. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got another Matt and Oren episode on the books. We're going to be talking about a pair of our current obsessions, things that help us improve our craft and improve our practice, things that we are currently obsessed with focusing on that will improve our careers. You might call them goals, but I think it's just kind of like what's been top of mind for us recently. So, Oren, I cannot wait to talk to you about your current directing obsessions, your goals, the things that you were thinking about, the things you want to improve. But before we do that, we got to pay for this show, man. Patreon.com/justshootitpod is the place where you can throw us a buck or two to keep this show going. It is not just a two-person operation. It's not just me and Oren. We got a small cottage, a small village of people. Really, we're talking mostly about Noah.
Yeah.
And by mostly, I mean exclusively.
We also pay for many other expenses.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, sure. I need my podcasting outfit. You know, we don't record video, but I do still want to look professional.
He buys a new outfit every episode. It's really...
Yeah.
Anyway, patreon.com/justshootitpod is the place where you can throw us a buck or two. It keeps the show going, and that is very important. It is even essential to us. So, we always run into people and they always say, hey, thanks so much. This is great. I'd love to pick your brain. I'd love to buy you a cup of coffee. You've got 413 episodes of brain picking. So maybe throw us the equivalent of a coffee once a month.
Check out the Patreon. Yeah. But the other thing that we're doing for the show is we're going to do another live show, another live episode.
That's right. March 20th, under a month away.
Yeah, we're going to focus on casting, most likely. We're still putting the panel together, but we're excited. March 20th, next live episode of Just Shoot It. Come out. The people whose Super Bowl party we went to were like, we got all these beers we're not going to drink. And I was like, I am going to do a live podcast just to give away all these beers. But yeah, I'm sure there will be also something to eat and plenty of fellow filmmakers to talk to and maybe even some actors that will beg you to put them in your next project. So, you know, we all love people begging us for things, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And it's a great opportunity for you to meet other filmmakers. I feel like our last live show, we were both really invigorated by just cool people who want to talk about craft and can relate to one another in a pretty unique way.
Yeah. And if you do want to keep updated on when this live show is, all the details, probably the best thing you can do is follow us on Instagram at Just Shoot It Pod.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, without further delay, let's get into it, Oren. I've been dying to know, what have you been obsessed with lately?
I had a really busy few months, and then all of a sudden, I have nothing. I have all this open time. And this kind of will tie into the second topic that we're going to talk about too, the Instagram doom scrolling stuff. But one of the things that having all this extra time has given me is the opportunity to make all these director's cuts. And of course, we had a whole episode on director's cuts. And actually, a lot of people emailed me and sent me messages about how they enjoyed that conversation, because I guess people don't talk about director's cuts all the time. Anyhow, I've been working on these director's cuts. And one thing that I've kind of noticed about my work that's driving me crazy is that I feel like I have not been paying enough attention to eye trace, which I don't know if Walter Murch came up with this term or not. It might be from like the five C's of cinematography or something, but it's like an old term. Walter Murch, you know, famous editor that edited Apocalypse Now and The Conversation and wrote In the Blink of an Eye. So he has six rules of why you make a cut, and maybe I'll go through them real quick. And then
before you do that, I want you to define what eye trace is.
Okay. I was going to say, I'll go through them and then we'll dive into eye trace. But, eye trace is about where, when you are filming something, when you're framing a shot, where do you want the people's eyes to be? You know, usually it'll be on a face, on an object, an insert shot, it'll be on a hand. So eye trace is important when you make a cut, because if someone is looking at the left side of the screen and you cut to something on the right side of the screen, it will take them some time to get
their
to the
eye,
right
literally,
side of the screen.
Yeah. The amount of time that it takes. Less for, like, you know, in the blink of an eye, your eye can move from one spot to the other, but like the level of comprehension and flow, basically, it takes you out of it.
Yeah. So to design a well-crafted sequence, it's nice if your eyes are kind of flowing around the screen in some sort of intentional manner. So let me just read Walter Murch's six rules. Just, I'm sure probably almost all of our listeners have heard them before, but just as a reminder, this is something I'm really focusing on for my work this year. All of these rules, but especially eye trace, and I'll kind of dig into it in a second. But so he has six rules of why you make a cut in an edit. And of course, he's a feature film editor, but this applies to YouTube videos, short films, everything. I mean, especially now in like the TikTok heyday of transitions and match cuts and things, people are thinking about this all the time. But potentially the TikTokers don't order these rules in the same way that Walter Murch did. Okay, so first reason to make a cut is for emotional reasons. How will this cut affect the audience emotionally at this particular moment in the film? So, you know, someone is looking at something shocked, right? And we see their face, and then we're going to cut to see that she is seeing her husband and her sister in a bed together, whatever, right? There's some like emotional reason that doing making this cut has and evokes. So that's number one reason. The second reason, most important reason, is for the story. Does the edit move the story forward in a meaningful way? So I think my first example applies here, but also, you know, somebody looking at a map of a bank and then, you know, getting in their car is implying that like we're going right from, we're going to go to the bank and it's kind of moving the story forward. I'm sure there's much better examples of that. The third reason to make a cut is for rhythm, is the cut at a point that makes rhythmic sense. And Walter Murch, do you remember this? He kind of famously said that he'll watch a shot a few times and hit the space bar or hit stop as the video is playing to find the exact right place to make a cut. And that there is like a rhythm to actors' movements and performances and things that kind of call for certain frames that are great to cut.
If memory serves, it has something to do, or oftentimes correlates to, when actors are blinking, right? Like that when an actor is in the moment, their train of thought has ended, or they're in between thoughts, they'll often blink. And that tends to be when the rhythm of the emotion and of the scene also wants to cut.
Yeah.
If memory serves.
Yeah. Totally. And I just did this little video that, like, breakdown video I put on Instagram, where I was showing how I used three extras to kind of build like a tailgate scene, you know, which, you know, a tailgate, like before a football game, should typically have like thousands of people and hundreds of people. And like, how can you, with just like a few actors and a few extras, build a scene? So I took this 15-second commercial of it that takes place at a tailgate, and I tried to cut it down shot by shot and show where I put these same three extras in each shot. And I put it on my Instagram channel if you want to check it out. But when I first edited it together, as soon as I cut to the shot, I would like freeze frame it and point to the actors. And I noticed that the rhythm of the dialogue was off, you know, like in some shots I would do the cut right before someone spoke, and in other shots, I put the cut like at the freeze frame after people spoke. And I noticed that just watching it was kind of difficult, because you expect a certain rhythm sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, music videos, there's obviously anything musically driven, but even a dialogue scene, a comedy scene, the rhythm is so important in terms of where you put cuts and why you put a cut in a certain place. So third reason, rhythm. Fourth reason, this is the topic that I want to talk about today, is eye trace. So how does the cut affect the location and movement of the audience's focus in that particular film? So again, if you have, you know, you're kind of using the rule of thirds and you're framing someone on the left side of the screen, and then you cut to someone that's on the right side of the screen, then you cut back to the left side, like that works, but there is like this tennis match type of reaction, right? Like as the viewer, you're going back and forth from right to left to right to left. If you want kind of quicker, starker, like if you want to be able to edit faster, then you put your, you know, that they'll still, that your actors will still be facing left and right, but you put them closer to the middle of the screen, so people's eyes aren't darting back and forth. And so that's eye trace. His fifth reason is two-dimensional place of screen. Like, is the axis followed properly? Basically not crossing the line, the 180-degree line, right? If Matt and I are talking to each other, we just keep the camera on the same side of the line that's formed between the two of us. And then his last reason is three-dimensional space. Is the cut true to established physical and spatial relationships? And I think if you read his book, he talks about how the sixth reason is for continuity. Like, it's another word for continuity. And I think by putting it as number six, he's kind of saying like, yes, continuity is nice to have, but it's not nearly as important as an emotional reason to cut, or a story reason, or a rhythm or eye trace. And, you know, I think a lot of editors, especially when they're starting off, or especially when they're not editing their own stuff, they'll be like, yeah, I can use this take because the continuity was off. Like, her hand was up, his glasses were on her. And you're like,
who cares?
Yeah, yeah. Who cares? Like, I've changed shirts on actors from take to take and nobody's noticed it. You know, like if the emotion
especially
is right, the flow,
if your eye trace in particular, if you're focused. If everyone's focused on the things you want them to be focused on, then they're not paying attention to those little tiny details anyway. To me, the two-dimensional place and the three-dimensional place or space, those are pretty distant from the top four, right? Those bottom two, essentially, are you breaking any geographic rules?
Yeah.
Look, they're important. And also, frankly, you know, at this point in your career, as long as your camera movements aren't totally crazy or your blocking gets really gnarly and you have to cut out the middle of the scene, for the most part, those we've internalized and we're not breaking those rules much anyway.
Yeah. I will say two-dimensional place is important only in that it can easily bump you, you know, like crossing the line.
Sure,
like I'd shot this thing that my Pinterest project last year, and we had a scene where it's in a conference room at a conference table, and we had actors sitting around the entire conference table all talking to each other. And, you know, our cinematographer really wanted to shoot on the shadow side. Like, you know, he wanted the main light source to be like on the other side of the camera, so everyone's backlit. But at some point it just didn't make sense for the actors blocking. And so I was like, dude, Adam, just shoot from the light side. Like it just, it's driving me nuts that people are facing this direction that doesn't match like the wide shot. And in the final cut, like the editors didn't seem to care about crossing the line. And I do find that scene like a little harder to watch because even though the performances are great, the comedy's great, like everything is working, the eye trace is fine. But yeah, so crossing the line is one of those things that like just takes you out of places, but emotion, story, rhythm, and eye trace, like keep you in, you know? So anyway, but I agree with you, which is the continuity is like the technical stuff is the least important stuff when it comes
to
editing.
What makes a great cut has more to do with emotion, story, rhythm, and eye trace than it does how clean your geography is.
Yeah.
Let's dig into the topic at hand though, eye trace, right?
Yeah. Before I do want to just mention one thing about like rhythm, which is in one of my director's cuts that I was working on yesterday, I had this shot of a guy walking into a living room where the camera kind of track, we're on a dolly and the camera tracks with him. And then we cut to a shot of him like getting to a couch and sitting down. And that shot, the camera wasn't really moving. In the first shot, the dolly is moving and then it stops and lets him leave the frame. And then we cut to the next shot. And I felt like the flow was really off to see like the dolly move. And so in that situation, again, it was a director's cut, so I got to do whatever I wanted. I just bumped it in, you know, we're shooting 6K or whatever on Sony Venice. So I blew it up by 20%, and then I added a camera move. Instead of the dolly stopping at the end, I had the dolly continue. And then I also, you know, pushed in on my next shot where he gets to the couch, and I added a camera move in post. And I think a lot of these things can kind of be fixed in post. Like, obviously, you should never rely on it, but if something is bumping you because a camera move or because of eye trace, like I do this all the time. I purposely try to shoot everything as wide as I can. Like I do like very loose medium shots. I try to always get like a wide shot, like head to toe. And even I don't even do like a lot of like close ups nowadays, but if I do, I like always try to include shoulders. And then in post, if I do need to move where someone is on screen, I just like blow it up a little bit and rearrange them. And I think it's like a big tool that like a lot of editors, I mean, a lot of directors and cinematographers are super precious about like their framing, and they don't like it when editors reframe their things. But for me as an editor, when I'm editing my own stuff, I reframe like I'd say like 50% of the shots
all the time. Yeah. So let me ask a technical question then, because I agree. I always shoot an extra 15%, and we'll, when I'm on a client job, I'll have the AC put up a border and be like, that's grayed out. So that that 15%, is semi-transparent. I can see what they're getting. I can see if there's a boom pull or whatever. And typically I tend to not care, but, I tell everyone who's watching, the client or the agency or whomever, like, hey, this is for safety. This is so that we can reframe things if we want to. And people tend to be pretty savvy about it. But like the expectation is that we will start at a 15% bump in and then pull out if we want. So compose for that 15% bump in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have extra pixels if we need it.
Yeah.
Do you do that, or is that something you kind of just...
It's something I've been doing like over the last 2 years. And even on the client monitor, sometimes we'll like zoom it in or we'll tape it off so they can't see the extra 15%. Yeah. But we know we have it. And it's funny. I'm finishing, you know, all of my director's cuts, and I'm like, should I finish them in 1080p or in 4K? Because, you know, all the cameras we shoot on are... at the very least 3.2K, if not 4K, like 4K or 6K or 8K or whatever. And really, ultimately, like 1080p is great to show people, to put on Vimeo or whatever. But it's that thing that you're talking about that has made me kind of finally appreciate the 4K of it all, or the 5K is just being able to do all this post reframing. You know, it's still, you're still kind of at the mercy of like the optics of your lenses and everything, mm-hmm. and the size yeah. of your sensor and the, like how sharp things are. So you're not like blowing things up like 200% on a regular basis, but you can blow them up 30 to 40% and still have a great image. And you have all these pixels on the edges that you're mm-hmm. using. So it's, I love it because in when I, you know, I work on these 15 second, 30 second commercials, like doing a little reframe can make or break a commercial. It can make something clear or confusing. And so on the topic of eye trace, like why I've really been thinking about this is because as I've been editing my own footage and looking at my director's cuts, I've been noticing that there are some jokes and things that mm-hmm. I feel like aren't really playing because as you're watching the edit, your eyes are just like not in the right place to see a funny thing. And mm-hmm. I like to choreograph a lot of things happening in the frame. I like to do a lot of stuff with extras and background actors and layers and depths and put like Easter eggs in and little details. I find that because I haven't really been focusing on eye trace enough, like so much of my, what I'm intending is missed, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of times clients and agencies will just edit it out because they're like, well, yeah, this is a cool idea, Oren, that you had, but it's not really working in the edit and we'd rather have more time on the end card or on the product. And I have been looking at stuff that I really love and adore and admire. And, you know, I've been pushing like over the past 5 years or so, really pushing to have as many wide shots as possible in my work. Because I think that's like where you're can do more storytelling and world building. But I've noticed that in the work that I like, even the stuff that's like has these epic wide shots, it's still super clear where you should be looking, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because I think when we talked about this offline, when I think eye trace, I think of, to your previous point about being able to cut really quickly, right? Like I think of Mad Max Fury Road. Like, mm-hmm.
yes, but someone posted a video about how perfect the eye trace is on that.
The eye trace is perfect. And essentially what it means is that like there are sequences, I think in particular, the like sequence where Charlize Theron and Mad Max like first kind of finally confront each other. Like they've gotten away from the War Boys and Immortan Joe, if you want to get specific. But like basically it's the first time to kind of like decide to band together and they're kind of fighting in the sand next to the big rig. Is like your eyes can stay in essentially the same spot on the screen for shot reverse shot, tons of action, most of that sequence, and it's masterful. And so that's kind of what I thought that you were going to be talking about a little bit is more about how you can use eye trace to keep things really consistently clear in a high paced environment. But what it sounds like you're talking about a little bit more, the thing that you want to work on is a little bit more nuanced than that, right? Because to your point, you love to choreograph camera moves and lots of depth and actors moving back and forth. You have a Popeye spot where it's like everyone's eating wings and they're walking through Z space, like towards camera back, and like there's all sorts of body wipes and people happening in the background and stuff. And I wonder if maybe what you're saying, Oren, is about clarity or simplification and less about specifically eye trace as a technique.
Well, but I think like some of my favorite commercials have all that complexity of movement and like loaded with funny details. Then you can rewatch them and catch new things every time, but you get like the most important comedic value the first time you watch it. And so my Popeye spot is like a perfect example. So there's this shot where the premise is that this woman is the tagline is like Popeyes is crashing the wings party. So everyone knows about Wingstop and KFC and a few other companies that are very famous for wings. Popeyes, even though they're famous for chicken, has never sold wings before now. So the idea is that this woman is coming to this party where people are eating all these like quote unquote crappy, sad looking wings. Mm-hmm. And she's replacing all of their wings with Popeyes wings, which are delicious mm-hmm. and amazing. And they actually really do have done very well in taste tests and stuff. So That was exciting. Obviously, that did not affect whether I took the job or not, but I was happy to hear that.
Nice.
That the wings are pretty good. Yeah. And I had some and they're delicious. But so there's this combination of things that's happening. Not only is this woman talking to camera about how she's crashing a party, but she's also replacing everybody's wings at the party with Popeye's wings. And
I've watched that shot with you many times. We went through the breakdown of how you change things in VFX, and I don't think I got that.
Right. So that's one thing that I think is really missed, is that she is literally taking wings away from people and putting Popeye's wings in in their place. So like right when she walks in, she hands somebody like a box of Popeye's wings. And I think because the camera's moving and she's moving, like that one, I'm okay that we lose. And then the next shot is she bumps these like crappy, sad looking wings out of the way with a Popeye's wings as a guy's hand is coming in to grab them. The idea was that he was going for the crappy wings, but she replaced them with the Popeye's wings. Then we tilt up to her and him, and she has some line, and that's fine. The next shot is like we're on the wings and we're pushing into this guy. As we're pushing into him, she's pulling his plate. He has a plate of wings. She's removing, but you're not really noticing that because you're looking at the wings in the foreground.
So like I said, like if you had asked me what the concept of that spot was, I would very confidently say a lady gives people wings.
Right.
Like the aspect of like sad wings are getting replaced or whatever. I did not see him.
Right.
I did not see him.
So there's a perfect example of what I want to work on. But the next shot is the one I really want to talk about, the one that made me worry about this eye trace thing. So in this close-up shot of the chicken that she's bringing to this guy, it's like the chicken cam, right? The camera is literally connected to the box of chicken. We see a hand come in, and then we cut to a two shot, right? Where we see the owner of that hand come in and grab this chicken wing. Now she's also imparting a lot of information about it. Like they're crispy on the outside, they're juicy on the inside. She picks this,
all the different flavors, all that stuff.
She picks this wing up, and then the camera pans over to some guy saying like, "Hey, who are you? Like, why are you in this house? Why are you here? Nobody knows who you are." But in that two shot, there's kind of a lot of stuff being communicated. There's this woman who's excited about seeing these new Popeye's wings because they look delicious. There's this guy whose wings have just been taken away and he's been handed these new wings. And he's looking at this woman who handed him the wings with this exasperated look of like, what the, you know, like a WTF kind of look on his face. And those two things are happening kind of on opposite sides of the screen, you know? And I think where your eye goes to is the motion of this woman's hand. She's pulling the chicken up, and you're kind of missing her excitement and you're missing his befuddlement. And you're not really getting a great shot of the chicken. And it's because there's three different places that on the screen that
you're supposed
things are
to be
happening.
Looking and clocking. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think like, even if I just went to just up to the man's face, you know, and he's like looking confused, and then went over to the woman with her chicken wing and she's like, ooh, and then go over to the third guy that's like, who are you? And that's actually how I storyboarded it originally, but I just, when I was timing it, I just did not have the frames to do that. But that would have told the story in a more clear way. And I'm kind of realizing two shots are just, you can't give a ton of information fast in them unless it's like a person punching someone else or like hugging someone else or shaking someone else's hand. Like unless the action is these two people interacting very quickly together with each other, having two different things happening on screen at the same time is like most viewers will miss one or the other.
They have to miss one. Yeah.
Unless you're sitting on it for like, you know, a minute, like unless you're watching, you know, a feature film that's all playing out in one two shot.
Yeah. And then I would argue that like oftentimes the two shots that I think of that I love the most that are about the connection between the two parties, they're still pretty loose. It's very rare that you would see a two shot where you've got, you know, you're in an anamorphic sequence and one person is at one end of the screen and the other is at the other. They're super far away. And that, you know, I'm sure there are really wonderful examples of those that escape me at this moment. But like, it tends to be really that the two people become one kind of in the center of the frame. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But like, yeah. And in my example, the two people aren't really interacting with each other. They're looking at someone. So it's like, if you did a scene,
they could practically be two split screens.
Yeah.
You would. Yeah.
If you did a scene where you walked into a room, right? And then we cut wider and we see you're not wearing any pants or underwear. And then we cut to reverse and see two people reacting, like, right. One person's like, does a spit take, another person faints.
Like Porky Pig in it.
Like if you're only on that shot for like 2 seconds, you're either going to see the spit take or you're going to see the faint, but it's going to be hard to register both.
And also those people are both kind of on the same page. So that I could imagine that shot working, one person faints, the other person spit takes, but like the gist is kind of the same. They're different flavors of the same sentiment, you know, even though the reactions are different.
Yeah.
What you were describing are two different beats, right? One person's happy, the other person's sad in your spot, which is even harder to track.
Yeah. Right? But even in this spit take fainting shot, I think it really only works if it's like spit take, boo,
then faint.
Woo,
faint, yeah, right? 100%.
If you have them both happening at the same time, like
if it's like,
yeah. And so again, you know, if you're making a short film, a movie, whatever, you can get those rhythms into the shot. But when you have 1 second for this, like I can only spend as much screen time on this as it takes to say crispy on the outside, right?
Yeah.
Crispy on the outside. And then,
and this is the root of all these problems. What you're describing is a 15 second commercial that has 3 seconds or 4 seconds of an end card.
Yeah.
Right.
So 12 and seconds. So, yeah.
12 seconds. Right. So, and you're layering all of this stuff in. So I think I stand by the note within the note that you're giving yourself, Oren, is that like, the best commercial scripts are the simplest and the least convoluted, right? So the more you have to layer in additional ideas on top of every frame, which is a thing that I know you love to do, but the more disparate those facts or ideas are, if they're not all complementary and essentially reinforcing the same focal point, then that's when things get confusing. And that could be where your eye is, or hearing something different than what you're seeing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're big into see and say, like all of that stuff makes things more complicated and convoluted. And like, as directors, we are in the weeds on all of those teeny tiny details. And a creative director or agency person in general has to be more top line because they have been on this account for a long time and they know the ins and outs of what product is coming next quarter and what they just did and what the tastes of the client are and, you know, kind of the big picture stuff. Right. So like we can say like, it's confusing to need to hit all of these points and we only have a second and a half to hit them. Kind of, sometimes it falls on deaf ears, not because they don't care. They care very much, but because they're just literally dealing with other things and all of our work is in the details of the thing.
Yeah. And I mean, in that Popeye specifically, I said to them, look, this is at the fastest light speed version of this. If I had the Micro Machines guy read all this dialogue, it's an 18 second commercial. There's no way around it. And I pitched.
Because what did you do then? What did you do?
I edited together the storyboards in three different ways. I ended up, instead of having my sequence of going from person one to two to three, I just went from a two shot to a single, right? So that was the mistake I made of trying to compress this story into one frame.
You're people pleasing a little bit. Your bosses are like, we need all of these things. And so you're like, well, here's a way to do it.
They said, yeah, we showed your mock-ups to the client and they don't want to lose anything. So just figure out a way to make it work. That's why my director's cut is 20 seconds. And I think my director's cut, while you still miss a lot of that stuff, the replacement of the chicken, I think at least you register that this woman is, nobody knows who she is, you know, at least by the time you get to the last
the story
guy.
Of it, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's difficult because the client has their RTBs, you know, the reasons that people want, the things they want to say about their product, and they value that much higher than the comedy or the rhythm or the pacing. They don't care about Walter Murch's 6 rules of cutting, you know? But the agency wants things to be dynamic and exciting and the cameras to move and do all these things. And those things kind of work against each other. And I guess my one word of caution for our listeners that are maybe getting to commercials or newer in this kind of client space, you can take storyboards and edit them together and put them on a piece of page or in a deck, or you can put them even in an animatic with sound effects and things, and it will seem like it's going to work. But once you get on set and you see how long it takes to move the camera from one place to another, or even do a pan, and that pan is going
to
take
you can't 18 frames.
Yeah. It just doesn't work like that. And it's all, the timing is everything, especially in commercials. So
I wish that so I love an animatic, as we've talked about for years on this show at this point. I wish that more frequently you would show them the animatic to say, like, listen, can you hear how quickly my voiceover is? I sped this up 200%, blah, blah, blah. And it's still coming in at 18 and a half seconds. It's very rare that anyone is ever like, oh, you're right, we need to rewrite things.
Right.
You know, it almost always falls on deaf ears. So like, well, you got to figure it out somehow.
No. And on that shoot, I posted this on Instagram, but I averaged like 35 takes per shot. Mm-hmm. And it's because I would do the shot and the script supervisor would say that was 2.5 seconds. It needs to be 1.5 seconds.
Yeah.
Do another take, another take.
And that's nice that they were able to do that for you and that you had that information to supply to them. The other thing that, this spot is a perfect example of this. You're dealing with the fatigue of overworking the material, right? By the time you're on set and you're on take 35, not only have people watched 35 takes, they've also seen the boards presented probably a couple times, first in a PowerPoint deck, then, you know, maybe you walk them through them a little bit, and then you show them an animatic a little bit afterwards, and they've approved every single piece of set deck, and all of the actors have, you know, they've seen their tape and their auditions and everything is very, very familiar. So it's easy to become numb to the different layers that you're putting on top of it. You're kind of constantly forced to keep them engaged and keep them impressed. But no audience member is ever going to watch this commercial
right
as many times, unless it's the BMO commercial and you watch a lot of Paramount or Disney Plus. Yeah,
or Drive Time. Seen that one a bazillion times sure. on Hulu.
You make the deal yourself, Warren. What can I say?
Yeah. So it's all a really good point. It's funny. There's this double-edged sword as a commercial director where you spend two to three weeks convincing the agency that you know exactly what you're doing. They should trust you. And they're like, yes, this works perfectly. And then you're like, I mean, there is this one little issue. And they're like, don't worry about it. And by the time you get to set, they're barely even paying attention because you've convinced them to trust you. And then you're in the edit.
He's got it.
You're like, yeah, this is tricky. But I will say one other kind of little trick that I did for my director's cuts that I think helps a little is I just added a lot of sound effects. Like that woman in the two shot, the woman that likes the chicken and that's excited about the chicken versus the guy that is, confused about why his chicken just got taken away. My wife and I just did sound effects. So when his chicken gets taken away, I go, huh? And then when she picks up the chicken, my wife goes, ooh, you know, and and it's like subtle, but I think those tiny little micro cues, you know, and who knows who's even listening with sound, but do help tell the story. And that's like one of my quick solutions for director's cuts. If something's not clear, is just trying to emote and sound the things that are important, or even if it depends how stylized it is, but even like sucking out the background sound to let like a bite of chicken be like sound especially delicious or something, or gross, you know.
Yeah, or it's got ASMR commercials is what we're saying.
Yeah. I'd love to hear from our listeners, like if you think about iTrace, if you care about it. I'm sure our editor listeners do, but email us, let us know your thoughts on it. justshootapod@gmail.com, or you can hit us up at justshootapod on Instagram. iTrace, that's my thing I'm working on. I'll let you know how it goes on the next project.
The thing that I am currently obsessed with, the goal that I have, I've been working on a new screenplay, and as a parent and also as a person who's working a full-time job show running, the amount of time that I have to dedicate to my own projects is pretty finite. And that's in addition to, of course, the feature that I'm getting going, and that takes a lot of time and energy and just kind of like, anyway, busy people understand this. I'm sure plenty of people at home know you only have a certain amount of time to work on your creative projects every single day. I'd been waking up early, and that'd been really great, but it's a little bit of a variable because it's hard to know when my kid is going to wake up. You know, mm-hmm. if I wake up at 5:30 in the morning and I'm like, ah, this is great. And then she wakes up at 5:45. It's pretty demoralizing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, no, they're getting things done in the morning.
Or even 6:30. The problem is it was my life for so long. I wrote before my day job when I was at Comedy Central. It is the reason that I have a career, is I could wake up at 5:30 or so, 6 even, and like get into the office around 10 and have put in a real honest to goodness writing session. Those writing sessions are now shorter and they're much more tenuous, we'll say, right? When my kid wakes up, how long it takes me. I'm bouncing. I'm waking up slower now than I used to. I used to be a six-hour person. It was no problem. Now, if I'm under 7 hours, I'm in deep, deep trouble. And it takes a couple of espressos before I get going. And then, yeah, so I have to be quiet, right? Like if I need to grind beans, oh man, I'm in trouble.
Who would trade grinding beans for waking up early? For waking up your kid, I mean. Like I would drink.
I pull out the pen and paper for sure. I don't.
Wait, what does the pen and paper do?
To write rather than grind. If the choice is grind the beans and risk waking your kid up, and therefore no longer writing, I would rather write longhand
without coffee.
Without risking waking her up. Yeah.
Yeah. But why do you need to write longhand?
Because that's the only... I guess that's true. What am I saying? I don't know. I can just write without coffee is what I'm saying.
I guess I'm saying, sure. Just get some freaking instant coffee, man.
Jesus. Or just grind your beans in advance, which is what I do.
Yeah, I guess you can do that.
Anyway, which is a really long way of saying I have been struggling to pick the next project. I've got a lot of ideas.
And when you say next project, you're talking about a screenplay.
Screenplay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's been
Have you decided if it'll be a feature or a pilot or a short?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I will dilly dally with the idea of like, oh, what if I shot like a short that can kind of be a little bit of a proof of concept for the feature that I'm currently doing, or, you know, experimentation at some time, like a little warm up. Ah, you could write 6 pages in one sitting. No problem. You do that all the time. Get down, you know. That can be one morning, and then it ends up being a week of kind of wasted time of like, I don't really know what this is yet, and you're exploring things and you're erasing things. And then all of a sudden you've got this limitless sort of set of possibilities. And so I've been really working towards trying to narrow down what specifically I want out of these projects. And so a feature is the thing that I think I have been craving spiritually, honestly, as well. Something that you can really sink your teeth into and is really about character. And I think it's because the work that I have been doing has lots of characters, but, you know, the show is historical. And so you're kind of just, I'm mining history to make it fit a narrative rather than crafting a narrative from whole cloth. And so I miss that. I miss being able to like write dialogue instead of like finding first person accounts of a person who said this or that, right? Like if Stalin didn't say it in that episode, then I can't put it in there, or whatever, Eisenhower's quotes or whatever. Even if they're batshit or really funny or whatever it is. And then on the commercial side, you know, scene work, like really having people interacting with each other, is the thing that I've been missing. And so I think a feature scratches both of those itches, and I think makes sense career wise as well.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you have a feature that you're trying to get off the ground right now that you're basically, you know, packaging, producing, sure, working on, is there not more value in also like your secondary project being like a TV pilot or a short or proof of concept or a spec or a music video, or like, is there, if like once this other feature gets going, is that not going to like take away from, I don't know, I guess, is this like, are you just kind of stockpiling, here's like the projects for the future, or is it more like,
yeah,
here's, I mean, something having, I can work on while I'm waiting for the cast to come together and like the financing to come together?
I think it's more of a stockpiling thing, right? Because in success, you know, we shoot this movie late summer, early fall of this year. That's enough time to have written a feature for sure. And to have, you know, you sit on a first draft or whatever, but like, we'll shoot that movie and then I'll be in post and then I'll kind of be ready to start rewrites on something or start something new. And then before you know it, you're touring with festivals or you're taking meetings or all of that stuff. And there's the inevitable question of like, oh, what's next? Right. And it would be nice to be like, well, you know what? While we were prepping this one, I kind of just had this other one going in the as a back burner. And I'd love to tell you about it a little bit and send you a draft. Feels smart career-wise. You know, a TV show for a long time, that's where all of my heat was in series and selling shows and things like that. And it just hasn't felt like that's an avenue for me right now, you know, like that part of my career has cooled. And so if I'm shooting a new film, then it wouldn't it make sense to be like, well, this is what my next film is.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it, like, I kind of feel like part of the reason you're shooting the film, obviously you want to tell the story and you're excited about it and it's mm-hmm. a piece of art and entertainment and within its own right. But from the view of your career, it's also like, hey, here's Matt's feature. You know, he's produced features. Mm-hmm. He's directed episodic, all sorts of different things and a feature and told this like awesome story and has like a unique visual aesthetic and cool effects and characters. And now we would trust him with a TV show of this same genre, you know?
Sure, sure. But I feel like,
unless you want to make something totally different.
Yeah, no, totally agreed. But I think the step, I don't think that anyone says, oh, wow, we love your feature. Can you create a TV show for us? That would be great. I would love that. But I think the immediate step, oh man, we love your, we saw your feature at Sundance or South By or wherever. We'd love to interview to direct it, do a couple episodes of this show that's already running. Like to get something going, I'm not sure, great, I love it. But like, I feel like you hear more anecdotes of someone booking a few directing episodes of a television show before they're creating their own show again, even though my resume is different than other people's, you know?
Yeah, I think that landscape has kind of changed a little bit. You look at like Jordan Peele, who obviously comes from TV, but then Get Out, it's kind of like defined him as a director mm-hmm. and a filmmaker. And then he's like an EP and directed pilots and also very involved in TV and more features, obviously. So I think nowadays, like when someone is looking for a unique voice to helm a TV show and like from a financial point of view, like TV is where there's money, you know,
sure,
versus indie film.
Made. Sure.
Like why? I don't know. To me, if yeah. I made like another feature, I would try to pair it with like the thing I can bring to town and like mm-hmm, get mm-hmm. A bunch of people to rally around instead of like
no,
another.
I think that's valid.
Going yeah. off to Milwaukee to shoot another indie feature.
I mean, another way of thinking of it is that, you know, presumably I find new reps out of this movie, right? And what are reps looking for? They want to look at you and be like, oh, this is how I can make money for my company
right.
through their work. And so if I'm like, well, I've got another indie movie, they'll be like, okay, great. Well, you know, call us in 3 years then or not.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had a TV show to sell thereafter, there you go. I wonder if some of why I want to write another movie is to hedge my bets a little bit, right? Because you don't have to ask permission to make a movie in quite the same way that you have to
yeah,
ask permission to make it a TV show. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, independent TV is technically a thing for sure. And like, you know, back in our day, we used to call it web series. I could always just go make another movie after this one.
Right. And in fairness, I'm just kind of projecting like what I would do if I actually did anything.
Sure. And you're not wrong, right? Like the answer is I should have both and like whatever.
Yeah. But also you can adapt a feature to a TV show or whatever, right?
Sure.
Like, yeah, there is certain stories that, you know, can work in both. We were talking about Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the TV show. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which was an amazing movie, you know, like we've seen it go in both directions, TV to movie and movie to TV. And yeah, I'm in full support of your goal. Writing.
Love it.
Writing more and yeah, grinding coffee less. The other thing, just to segue into this real quick, it's kind of about Instagram for me. It's about doom scrolling. It's about like waking up and seeing what everyone else is working on. I've been posting a lot on Instagram the last couple weeks because I've finally had some time to do it, and I find that, you know, I posted this breakdown of the extras that I mentioned, and I had lunch with someone today and they're like, oh, I loved your breakdown, you know, and I went to an office and they're like, oh, I saw that, you know, and like kind of people come out of the woodwork. So I find it to be an effective way to start conversations, remind people of me. Someone from a production company today texted me, is like, hey Oren, I haven't talked to you forever and I saw your post, let's grab lunch on Monday, you know. So who knows what it leads to, but I do feel like there's some value to it. But today I was looking at other directors' Instagram pages and their posts, and they're all great, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you think you have a great post, then you see other people's posts, like, ah, that's a really great post, you know. It's like, this guy shot a Super Bowl commercial and he did this really inventive thing, and that's cool. But I've kind of started realizing that all the directors who I really admire and like on Instagram are also directing shorts that are going to South by Southwest or mm-hmm. episodic TV or mm-hmm. movies, you know, or working on these writing projects. I mean, granted, like 90% of them don't have kids. So it's like not a fair comparison because, you know, they have time to be selfish, mm-hmm. you know, or think about mm-hmm. their own passion projects. But I had a meeting today with an EP and she was telling me about this other company she was working with, and her partner at the company was a director and ran the company, and they had like five other directors on the roster and they had a staff of like 12 people or something. And he finally ended up deciding he didn't want to run a production company anymore because he felt responsible for the salaries of these 12 people on staff and mm-hmm. these five other directors on the
roster. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And she said he just didn't want to have to feed everyone anymore. He didn't want the stress of that. And it made me realize like, oh, I am like 90% reliant on commercial work to feed my family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I enjoy commercials, and you kind of pointed that out, that I would be like satisfied just kind of directing commercials all the time. But I realized like maybe I do need to make a short or just kind of do a passion project to have just like something else to talk about that's done like the way I want to do it and not at the whim of an agency or a client.
The cut is the director's cut.
Yeah. But also maybe there's like a psychological kind of release and kind of working on my own thing. And then like the third thing is, I think as a filmmaker that's trying to get commercial work, you are instantly more attractive if you have kind of quote unquote more important, meaningful things going on. Mm-hmm. And you're, you know, just taking a side break to do this commercial job.
Yeah. Well, so look, a lot to unpack there. Instagram, you know, I think we've talked about on the show, Carlin Hudson and I both periodically uninstall
right
Instagram,
and you're in a period of deleted Instagram.
I deleted Instagram.
So you haven't seen any of my posts.
I saw your post and I deleted it yesterday. I want to say,
as soon as you saw my post,
I was like, "Boy, we get it, Oren. Okay, move the chicken wing into a better spot." No, I totally relate to spiraling when you see people who are doing awesome work, then you want to be doing awesome work. And it's not that you don't want them to do awesome work, but when you feel low about your work, I've certainly spiraled on that, you know, many, many times. I wasn't actually feeling it in this case. It was more of like just attention management. I just didn't want to be wasting time. You know, Twitter's not really a part of my life anymore. Facebook's not really a part of my life anymore. I use TikTok in a very different capacity. TikTok is more like television than Instagram. So like, I don't find myself, I found myself leeching a lot of time in Instagram and also worrying a lot about how I use my time. And so I was like, okay, just get rid of this and don't worry about it. And, you know, I'll reinstall it later. And it's not, I did not delete my account. I can still post things, but, you know, like if I look at photos of my kid or like my wife texted me a few photos that she took or whatever, that scratches the itch of the initial Instagram of it all. I'm not comparing myself to other people right now. And that's nice. So there's that. That's kind of its own thing. But I think your point about like other directors doing work that you think is cool, whether that's a Super Bowl spot or a short or a South by Southwest feature, I think you're right, and also maybe being a little too hard on yourself. And this is a thing I've been thinking about a ton, especially actually in the way that it relates to your commercial career, weirdly enough. And we've talked about this a little bit, but Nikki Weiss told us that directing commercials is a part-time job. And that's always how I had approached it until essentially the pandemic. I would, you know, produce my wife's indie feature. I would do a bunch of sketches. I would do commercials. I would get a writing job, and I would kind of cobble together like a great standard of living and great life. That has changed since the industry has changed very significantly, and also my life has changed. My needs are much greater. I've got a kid and a house. And so I think it is really smart and valuable, especially if you don't have a ton of responsibilities, to keep things varied. It keeps you happier. It gives you things to talk about outside of the world of commercials. That can be impressive to a certain type of creative director. Of course, all of that makes sense for you know, how we understand the business to be. But then also, the industry is in a friggin' tailspin. There are fewer TV shows being made. There are fewer movies being made. People are not going to the movies unless it is a superhero movie, which has been true for the last decade, but it's really true right now. And so if you are a filmmaker who needs to make money, I would challenge you to name many things you can do besides rely on commercials. Television, right? Which you want to do, right?
Yeah, but it's much...
But it's a different ecosystem. You know what I mean?
Much harder to break into, for me, I believe, than commercials.
Yeah, well, and you have a body of work in commercials, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, neither of us planned on being full-time commercial directors, but to our point before, indie movies, you know, are not making very much money right now.
Right.
So like, and all of the things that I had described where I was making other money on writing gigs or this or that or whatever, I kind of like punted. I was like, okay, commercials are going to be tricky for me right now. Also, there aren't that many comedic spots being made in the last 3 years, right? We've been making jokes about, like, in the pandemic in particular, no one was touching comedy. It was all in these uncertain times. Toyota is right here.
But this year, supposedly.
This year, it's back. It's back. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I have seen more boards in January than I saw in 2023.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Which is to say, I've seen a lot of boards. I've been up for a lot of stuff, which is nice. So, you know, fingers crossed for everyone. But all of which is to say, it's like, it's a weird time right now.
Yeah.
And so
my wife just told me that she saw some article about how there's no jobs for actors or something.
Yeah, there aren't. There aren't. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, with this Sora AI thing that I mentioned last week, it's like already like half the filmmakers on Twitter are like, that's it. I'm out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess to me, like the positive way to look at it is it's kind of like what you said, like, don't rely on just one thing. Mm-hmm. Because we just can't control the trends in the markets and like what's in style and who's in style, you know, week to week or month to month or year to year. But also, yeah, I think if you have a few good months, I'm going to try thinking about this. I haven't like really thought deeply about it, but maybe I just don't worry about supporting my family for a few months and actually worry about supporting my creativity.
Well, the question is, when is enough enough, right? Like if you look at the numbers and you say, okay, well, I've got plenty of money for the next 2 or 3 months. Historically speaking, you're going to book something in a few weeks, right? So yeah, don't stress so hard and either live your life or make something cool that you can brag about that'll help you get that new job sooner.
Well, thanks, man.
You got it, buddy. Do you have a few more minutes to endorse with me?
Unpaid endorsements.
So I've got two. One is a TikTok that I sent to you that I actually wanted to talk about when we were talking about iTrace. It's by a creator that you have endorsed already yourself, OMG Adrian. I think he's one of those guys that has devoted himself to making a great TikTok every day or every week or something. I don't know what the threshold is for him. But he talks about composition specifically for vertical video. How does he make a vertical video great? And surprise, surprise, a lot of what he's talking about is iTrace. He centers his subject for almost all of his shots. And he does have a little bit of a move where rather than in a portrait, rather than placing someone flat to the plane of the camera, he'll, you know, shoot them at a 3/4, but center the eye that is closest to the lens, which I thought was a really good move.
Yeah.
That I haven't heard. Like, I think people do that instinctually, but like, to have it formalized like that, I was like, oh yeah, that's right, dude. Nice move. Nice move.
I saw that video of his and I thought that was interesting. You should check it out.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty good. We'll drop it in the show notes. The other one, essentially have a little hobby or have a little project. If you can, a way to burn off steam, a way to like build a little bit of fulfillment in your life as a person who's feeling very burnt out. Having a little something has been really nice. And as I'm watching TV with my wife, I do one of those. Do you know what a book nook is, Oren?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a little.
They're like room little teeny.
That is.
Yeah, scale models that are basically the size of like a thick book. Mm-hmm. And you like craft a little greenhouse, or mine's like a library study. And it's got teeny tiny little books in it and a little desk and a little telescope and it's got LED lights and all that stuff. And so while my wife and I are watching TV, I've been like slowly super gluing little books over the past few nights and it's been pretty enjoyable. Like literally it's like balsa wood and you sand it down.
That's crazy.
And then you cut like, you know, you cut out a little book cover and then you fold the pages. So like, many of them you can open up and they're all different covers, even though they're going to be on shelves and you can't even see the different colors. It's very inefficient, which is part of the joy of the hobby.
Yeah. This is a man who has no time for anything yet. You're building a book nook.
Oren, I'm building like 3 paper books a night.
So we got one for my daughter, Winter, but she... It's a little complicated for her to do on her own. So
yeah, she could certainly.
She's already lost
it.
Like half the pieces.
It's more that it's like it's really like an old man hobby. This is like the equivalent.
It's
of
like those Legos that's like for 21 plus.
Yeah, I was gonna say you're building a model ship inside of a bottle.
Oh yeah,
like the craft. The point is that it's labor intensive and that it's slow and that it's details exclusively. You know.
Yeah.
But really, just have like a weird little hobby.
Yeah, no, that's a great one.
Kaplan, what you got?
Okay, so The first one I'm going to say is it's basically what you were talking about, which is how Mad Max has perfect eye trace.
Mm-hmm.
If you just go to Twitter, like there's so many different videos. I guess there's this guy at Vashikoo, V-A-S-H-I-K-O-O, that made like the official video about how Mad Max Fury Road center framed everything and it makes the action so easy to follow. But of course, it's no longer available on Twitter. I don't know why. There's another guy. His name is Derek Liu, D-E-R-E-K-L-I-E-U. He's at Derek underscore Liu on Twitter or X. And if you look him up with and Mad Max at the same time, he has like a video where he shows a crosshair on like where your eye is supposed to be looking at in Mad Max. And he compares it to Taken. And he's like, look at the eye trace, how all over the place it isn't Taken. And then look at Mad Max and how easy it is to follow this fight versus that fight. So it's a great, great video. If you just Google Mad Max eye trace, which it's up to you if you want to make eye trace one word or two. I think it's two usually. You'll find some really cool video essays about it. So interesting thing. And then the other, I was just going to double down on two previous endorsements. One is those Pizza Party potato chips from Trader Joe's that I mentioned the other day.
Oh,
and I
was like, still into it.
I was like, yeah, they're pretty good. I've changed my endorsement to they are fucking awesome. Like so, so good. It's like you're so many flavors in one chip. I don't even really like potato chips that much, but I love these. I can eat a whole bag in like 2 seconds. And my other endorsement, I already sent you a video of it, but I received my $35 Mohu antenna for my TV. I think it's Mohu is the brand. M-O-H-U antenna. Does that ring a bell? Yeah, the Mohu Leaf Indoor HD TV antenna. $35. I just connected it to my Samsung TV, switched to like the TV mode on the TV, and I have NBC, I have CBS, I have Fox, I have KCAL, KCOP channel 13. I have all these channels totally for free. I can watch the Oscars. I can watch football. I can watch.
It's like it's Grammys. 1998 again.
I know. I'm so excited. Like I don't have to pay $90 for YouTube TV Live or whatever crap they're slinging on top of the 800 other, you know, subscriptions I'm paying for. So free TV. It's called an antenna. You just connect it to your TV and you can watch channels. So I got the Mohu M-O-H-U Leaf Indoor HDTV antenna and it works. You do need a TV though. You can't just connect it to like a computer monitor.
Can I ask, did you try it without the Mohu?
Like, yes.
Don't TVs have internal antennas?
Maybe, but it didn't work without the Mohu.
Yeah.
Like if I watch NBC and then I unplug the antenna, I no longer have NBC. There might be like some crappy like PBS channel or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's weird nowadays, like there's channel 4, which is NBC in LA, but there's 4-2, 4-3, 4-4. They're like
that's
different
weird
offshoots of NBC. And like each of the channels have kind of their like different versions and they're all HD. It's like 4K. Not 4K. HD 1080 or 720. I don't even know what kind of HD. HD 60i probably.
Sure. Somewhere in there.
But it's free and it's like, it just blew my mind that I've been like paying for Paramount Plus to watch the Super Bowl, you know, and then canceling it and then and like when I could have just plugged in an antenna.
Sure. And yeah. I mean, especially
I can watch the Tonight Show. I can watch all these things now.
The Oscars are coming soon. And like that one, that's the one we always will get like YouTube Live or whatever. And it's always kind of been a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to follow suit and get an antenna. That sounds great.
Yeah, Mohu, check it. You can get antennas that have like amplifiers or something, you know, like signal amplifiers, but supposedly they don't work that well. So just get this Mohu Leaf, trust me. Unless you want to put one on your roof, that's a whole different story.
I don't want to do that.
Anyhow, thank you, Matt. If you want to let us know what you think about iTrace, Instagram, screenwriting, waking up in the morning, working at night, email us justshootapod@gmail.com. Catch us on Instagram @JustShootItPod. You can find me. I'm @OKaplan.
And I'm @MrBadEnlo. This episode was edited by Noah Vishore. Thanks, Noah. And Tyler Small. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.